My name is Judith Brown. I worked as a manager of refugee healthcare programs in Africa and the Middle East for a number of years using WHO guidelines. The basis of my work, the fundamental underpinning of my work, included control of infections, because obviously in refugee camps that's an important issue. So that's something that I was always very familiar with. When I was working in Africa and the Middle East, the thing that struck me was that the things that I was seeing were very different to what I had expected to see, because for example, I was completely naive about the Middle East situation. But when I went to work in Lebanon, I was really shocked to see, for example, Hezbollah was held in quite high regard by UN peacekeepers, for example, and seemed to be doing a jolly good social program. And that was exactly the opposite to what I expected. And there were other things in Yemen and in Africa as well that didn't meet my expectations, well, didn't meet the expectations that I'd had before I went there. And that led me to do a PhD when I returned to UK, looking at the way that the media is influenced and media discourses, which made me very aware when the discourses started on COVID-19 last year. Firstly, I had a lot of knowledge of WHO guidelines and how infections were managed to stop their transmission. And what I was hearing was nothing like I'd ever heard before. And secondly, I was able to look at the media discourses, because you look at the main discourses, you look at the discourses of dissent, and then you look at the discourses that are never said. And what I was hearing, the discourses that I was hearing, was that this is a terrible pandemic and we've got to stop you meeting with other people, and it's very serious. And I, as I'd seen that the fatality rate was relatively low, I think over the year it's actually lowered even further, but it was, people thought that it was somewhere between 0.2 and 0.5%, which seems quite a low IFR. So I couldn't understand the extent of the restrictions and the amount of fear that was being generated in the population from that point of view. And also I could see that the media discourse that wasn't allowed was the one that I was feeling, which is, we really don't need lockdown at all. We need to have a more targeted policy, so that we're actually going to target the people at risk. Because right from the beginning, when it was in China, it was really obvious that this was a disease of people who were elderly or who had a number of serious health issues. And I felt that targeted health prevention strategies for those vulnerable people would have resulted in saving far more lives and would have kept the rest of the population operating normally. So on two contexts, I was immediately suspicious of the COVID lockdown. And that made me undertake my own investigations, which has only made me more certain that there seems to be some sort of a misinformation campaign that's directed not only at the public in UK, but also at the worldwide public, and that a lot of people seem to be believing that narrative, and it's very difficult to explain to them that there is a different narrative, particularly as we can't meet in person, for example.
Yeah, well, but since we're not supposed to, I think people are actually beginning to do that and have been obviously meeting otherwise. But I spoke to you when I was actually stuck over in New Zealand right at the very start of this, Judith,
yes,
and you were flagging up almost straight away some concerns that you had about the vaccines might interfere with each other. So, for example, citing a study of US soldiers where a load of them. I mean, these are lads in their sort of 20s, basically, who keeled over with COVID-19. When actually, obviously their officers and the other people in the army were scratching their heads. Well, these guys aren't really that vulnerable to it. They shouldn't be, you know, hospitalised or really sick with it. And it turned out that the batch that had all had the flu vaccine as well. So I don't think we've really been told that, you know, by having a flu vaccine, it might actually affect how you're hit by COVID.
Indeed. And in fact, it's not only that study, but various other studies since, and including some research that I've done that actually indicates that influenza vaccines do interfere with your immune response to many other respiratory diseases, particularly. And this has been recorded in, for example, children's studies over several decades. So in a sense, that was a bit like the Pandora's box, because early on, when vaccines for COVID were first being mooted very early, they started talking about it in February, March, when I actually Googled COVID vaccine, up came this study relating to the American servicemen. And interestingly, I later found that was the trial for the new style of flu vaccines, which were grown on dog kidney cells, before that they were grown on egg cultures, and since then, of course, the dog kidney cells are the main medium for growing.
Well, you know why this makes me so nervous, Judith, is because they're now talking about the COVID vaccines being something that also, like the flu vaccine, we have to have every year.
I know. And this is like totally illogical, because COVID isn't, coronaviruses aren't like flu viruses. They replicate in a different way, which means that they're less likely to have large mutations. Any mutations are likely to be just a few. For example, if they're large viruses, I think they've got, some people say 30,000 amino acids, but certainly they're over 10,000 amino acids. And the changes are maybe one or two cells. So it's really not going to make a significant difference. If you think that in 2003, people who had SARS, the first SARS outbreak, which was only 80% similar to SARS-CoV-2, but they still had resistance to SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19, even after 17 years. So therefore, it seems so unlikely that there's going to be a need to have vaccines repeated. And, of course, the other thing is that if you've really had a dose of COVID, you have your own antibodies and then your own T cell resistance, which is everybody has, and it stays there for many years, maybe for a lifetime. So to say that these people need a vaccine is quite unusual, and I can't understand why any healthcare professional doesn't think so. I can't understand their mindset. Does it mean to say that they've totally swallowed the propaganda and that's overcome their years of medical training or training in immunology? Or does it mean to say that they understand that the government is not being truthful with the population, but they're going along with it? And either seem very strange scenarios to me, but of course the medical profession largely is going along with it and is complicit, and I find it hard to feel forgiving towards people who aren't making a stand when they have.
Well, hang on though, because I mean surely there's an enormous element of groupthink here, is that it actually takes quite a lot of courage in a profession to step outside and say, well, actually, I think my profession has got this wrong. You know, it's almost like somebody like Copernicus, you know, saying, oh, actually, no, the the moon is going around the earth, or the earth is going around the sun, not the other way around. You know, you're almost it's a sort of brickbat country, and you're liable to get a whole load of people throwing stones at you.
Yeah, indeed you are, and maybe that encourages people to toe the line. But having said that, I mean, this, I'm not talking about ordinary members of the public, but I'm talking about doctors, immunologists, people who must know that once you've had a disease, you're going to have T cell immunity that's going to last you for a long time. And they're still going along with the government's statement that people have to be immunized. And it must somewhere at the bottom of their heart, or even higher up than the bottom, it must be made. There must be questions that are being raised. They can't be seriously thinking that that can be the case. So yes, I mean, when I was actually doing research into flu vaccines this last year, which I had never done before, I'd just accepted the government's and the medical profession's account of flu vaccines. But quite interestingly, a paper that was published in January last year by Anderson, a very large study that went on for 17 years, a study in UK, it actually showed that if you looked at the statistics, in the written report, it actually said that there was no difference, that people who had had flu vaccines they weren't hospitalized less, they didn't die more frequently. So therefore, there was no difference between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated. But that, quite interestingly, if you actually looked at the statistics, if you actually read the statistics that were on the tables within that research, what it actually showed was that men in particular were something like 27% more likely to get flu if they'd received the flu vaccine. And I just find it incredible that no one at Sage has read that, or if they have read it, that they feel that it's insignificant and that they can recommend people to have a flu vaccine, particularly men that are more likely to die if they have the flu vaccine, and also more likely to actually develop COVID. It almost seems like a recipe for helping people to die. And indeed, when you look at it, they started the flu jabs at exactly the same time as they started school rollout in September. Now, that's very early to give flu vaccines, but they actually started it almost at exactly the same time as schools went back. Of course, then there was an increase in the number of cases of COVID and in the number of deaths from COVID. You'll remember that there was a peak which went on particularly in the north of England in September, October. To me, that was predictable because of the flu vaccines. Lots of studies had shown that would happen. But of course, it was very easy to blame it on schools going back and saying, schools went back and therefore there was a rise in the number of cases, a rise in the number of people who died, but not looking at any other possible causative factors. I'm not saying necessarily that it's causative, but what I am saying is that there is research that indicates that there is an association. And to me, that indicates that before you do full rollouts and encourage people to have the vaccine, you should do more research to prove or disprove that the flu vaccine is more likely to cause people to become ill.
Now, another thing which, you know, you've reminded me, because it was August, September last year when they started the mass rollout of PCR testing. Yeah. And, of course, just after that, we saw a whole load of new big surge in cases. So they don't seem to be statistically accurate, really, to say, what I'm saying is there's not a level playing field. Before August, September 2020, we had much less testing going on.
Indeed.
And so one should have kind of expected a surge as soon as you're testing more people, especially when the PCR test is also picking up false positives on people who are not transmissible. Maybe you even had COVID back in March.
Yeah, indeed. And of course, the other thing is, at that particular time when they rolled out the PCR testing, they were very specific. I noticed on the few television programmes and radio programmes that I listened to, and lots of people told me that this was consistent, that they were actually changed the wording from tests for COVID-19 to test for coronavirus. So therefore, maybe they were acknowledging that that other coronaviruses were actually likely to be picked up by this PCR testing. And of course, coronaviruses are one of the causes, they cause at least 20%, 25% of common colds. And when children went back to school, of course, there may have been an increase in common colds, because children catch colds when they go back to school and when they intermix. But the wording that was said, it was changed from saying we've had these many positive tests for COVID-19 to that we've had this many positive tests for coronavirus. So the wording was actually changed.
Well, look, the big statistical nightmare right now apparently is India. We've had travel cut off between the UK and India. What do you put this down to?
Well, I think, first of all, I think that the government has a great interest, and governments throughout the world have a great interest in keeping the fear of COVID persistent. And if you can find a country where they have a large peak in cases, then India is a good example. And also, I think undoubtedly the healthcare system in India isn't coping. But that's hardly surprising, because under Modi, they've privatized the healthcare system and seriously underfunded it. And I think this healthcare system not coping has been an ongoing thing for a long time. The oxygen shortage is another issue, but apparently India knew that it was short of oxygen. It was reported not this March, but the March before. So you're talking about 13 months ago, and it didn't build up its stocks. But I think one thing that is quite interesting, and again, I'm not saying that it's causative, but it's an interesting notion. And this isn't to say that I'm not sympathetic with all of the people that have become ill or that have passed away in India, because obviously that's a tragedy for the people concerned. But interestingly, India, which has actually had a very low percentage of deaths per million, it's around 143, I think, at the moment, compared to us, which in UK, for example, where we're pushing on towards 2,000 deaths per million recorded as being related to coronaviruses. But so obviously, you've got much bigger numbers in India, and if you can say 3,000 extra people have died, and it sounds a lot, but it's not so big when you consider that the population is 20 times larger than UK. So there's various reasons why one thinks that the figures may have been manipulated. But if you go back to the summer, I did read an article which I've tried to look out for this evening, and I can't find it anywhere that where I've saved it. But there was an article to say that Modi had some differences over the vaccine implementation and distribution in India. I don't know what that difference was, but that decided to recommend ivermectin. Ivermectin, as you know, is a drug that is very safe, very effective against COVID, both prophylactically and for treatment. Looking at lots of random controlled studies, I think that one can say definitely it is. But Modi apparently started using ivermectin, and that was last August. And from then on, the number of cases in India sort of dropped quite dramatically, really. By September, you could see the sort of like the significant drop in cases, and that continued to be really low. they have a unit in India that manufactures AstraZeneca vaccines, and they also have an Indian vaccine. I'm not sure how many the Indian vaccine is using, but I think the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is manufactured under license in India, is the largest number of vaccines that are actually being given at the moment. And the vaccine rollout actually started on the 15th of January this year, and at that point ivermectin was dropped and the vaccine rollout started. First of all, for the first 2 months, all of the doses that were given to healthcare workers. They weren't given to vulnerable people, but the policy was to immunise all of the healthcare workers first. So through January, February, the people who were immunised tended to be younger people. And then the big rollout started last month. And of course, in similar to vaccine rollouts in every country, including in UK, the vaccine rollouts, for whatever reason, appears to be associated with a rise in both cases and deaths. And in this case, it was notable that it started when the vaccine started rolling out to vulnerable people, rather than when it was rolled out in January to the healthcare workers. So there does seem to be an association there in India, just as much as there are as one's seen that same association in the rest of the world. For example, in UK, because we gave our vulnerable people the vaccine first, then the peak went up, and then when we started immunizing people who were younger, then the peak sort of then the number of cases and deaths declined after that, but the peak in India has come a bit later because of a difference in policy. So what I don't want to say is that ivermectin that ivermectin was definitely stopping the cases beforehand, and the vaccine definitely has started cases and deaths, because I really don't know that. But what I'm saying is there is an association, and I think this is worthy of further investigations.
It seems definitely and obviously it is. Yes. If you know, 6 weeks, 2 months ago, the new program kicked in, which stopped the use of ivermectin and started the mass rollout of the vaccine, and now we're seeing a complete turnaround in India's fortune, surely someone needs to connect the dots.
Indeed. And in fact, I did read a letter from a friend of a Facebook friend that had sent to her from an Indian doctor, who's actually saying that a lot of Indian doctors now are thinking that they're going to start using ivermectin. I don't know whether they are allowed to use it under the Indian rules at the moment, or whether some of them just feel that they've been advised not to, so they're not going to. But I think that there are a proportion of Indian people now who are thinking that it is time to start using ivermectin. And it would be quite interesting to see if that did result in a reduction in cases. So that's something which we need to keep an eye on. Firstly, are many doctors going to have the courage to use it in the face of the hegemonic power saying, please don't use it? And secondly, if they do, is there going to be a reduction? So that's something in India that we need to keep looking at.
Yeah, and also I suppose, you know, it would be lovely to see if maybe just one of the Indian states reversed that decision as a kind of control experiment to see if it stopped the expansion of the vaccine. So I know, reading Robert Kennedy Jr.'s reports into Bill Gates's past exploits, and should we say experiments on human beings with vaccines, is we found that some of the vaccines that he's rolled out in the past have actually led to a mass epidemics of the very thing he's trying to protect against.
Yeah, particularly the polio vaccine, I think, that has been. And, of course, there have been other vaccines that have been associated with hormones added to them, which has actually made the recipients, young women, sterile. So there have been questions concerning Bill Gates's vaccine rollouts in the past, yes.
Yeah, well, also, you know, with ivermectin, this supposed cure, or at least, you know, it's supposed to be a better treatment than anything else, and it's very cheap. But the thing is, Judith, this is an anti-parasitic drug. It's got nothing to do with COVID-19 or influenza.
It has in a way, because antiparasitics actually enter cells, and viruses actually live inside cells, so therefore you would need a medication that can enter cells. So in a sense, you can see that the link between parasitic worms, for example, and fungi and parasitic viruses, because viruses are actually parasites if you think about it, because they don't have a life of their own. They're inert until they enter the cell, and then when they enter the cell, they're then able to replicate and spread to other people.
Well, so basically, what they do is they hijack the cell's reproduction mechanism for their own ends.
Indeed, yeah. So, but what you can see is that viruses are, loosely speaking, they do have some parasitic tendencies, so you can see why there's the drugs that are used for parasites are quite likely to be useful in viral diseases, which of course we've seen with hydroxychloroquine as well, which also results have been quite good for hydroxychloroquine. But as you say, and as I agree, ivermectin is very much more efficient.
Also, we've seen this kind of vaccine war going on, haven't we? As each of these big manufacturers comes out with a vaccine, we keep hearing news stories about AstraZeneca and how that's not good for you, this sort of thing. It almost seems like a kind of marketing going on through the news bulletins as to which one we should and shouldn't have.
Absolutely. I think that when you look at the statistics, it's quite interesting, because where they've rolled out Chinese vaccines, which I think is called CoronaVac or Sinovac, and where they've rolled out the Russian vaccine, Sputnik V, they seem to be much safer, and they're not associated with, or in the short term, they seem to be much safer and not have so many side effects, and they're not associated with a spike in deaths. So on the face of it, at the moment, the Russian vaccine and the Chinese vaccine appear to be somewhat better, particularly in terms of giving them to elderly vulnerable people, or the people who really seem to be having the severe side effects from the Pfizer vaccines, AstraZeneca. But yes, I think that there is an attempt to blacken the name of AstraZeneca, and undoubtedly it does have a lot of side effects, although you could say that maybe the side effects for the Pfizer vaccine in the long term, with its one's very unsure of exactly what cells the Pfizer vaccine is infecting, how long it's going to stay in the body, therefore it's got the potential for longer term side effects. Whereas if you look at the AstraZeneca vaccine, it's delivered on the agent that delivers it is a virus that lives in the throat, and obviously what happens is that once it's got into the body and produced the spike of those cells produce the spike of proteins that are very similar to the within the coronavirus, then the immune system is going to kill those adenoviruses that are in the throat, and therefore you can be fairly certain that it's going to be eliminated from the body. But the mRNA vaccines of Pfizer and Moderna, you just I don't know how long they are going to stay around. And certainly I've seen that said by a number of very eminent scientists and people who have been studying coronaviruses for a long time.
What about yourself and people you know, Judith? Have you had the vaccine? If so, which one? And do you know of any effects that it's had on people?
Well, me personally and my husband, we decided against having the vaccine, and there's been a lot of pressure on us, but we've decided against it. But quite interestingly, and it's, you're put into a very difficult position, Tony, when people that you know have had the vaccine and then have problems that you think may be associated with the vaccine. And then when you look at the MHRA vaccine adverse reactions reports, you can see that those diseases are appearing. For example, I've got a cousin in Western Supermare, a similar age to me, mid-70s, and she had the vaccine, didn't have any side effects, I don't think, initially, but then started passing blood from her rectum and has some sort of inflammatory bowel disease. She went to the doctors and I think that people were quite supportive of her, but nobody suggested that it was anything to do with the vaccine. But when she told me that she had this, I looked up on the website, and there, of course, between the two vaccines that were available at the time, Pfizer and AstraZeneca, there were around 10,000 cases of this inflammatory bowel disease. And another case, my sister-in-law, who's recently been bereaved, and that in itself is a very sad story, because her husband was in hospital for a long time, and she'd had COVID and her husband had had COVID. So really, them not being able to visit each other whilst he was in hospital was very sad, and he died. He did have a lot of health problems, but maybe being parted from his family was the last straw, but who knows. Anyway, one can't undo the past. But just after she had the vaccine, she got sort of problems with the retina of her eye, which eventually resulted in her having surgery on one of her eyes. And again, I look up the MHRA website. I think altogether something like about 20,000 reports of these retinal problems between the two vaccines, a huge number. And I just felt sort of like she hadn't had the second vaccine. And I was sort of like thinking to myself, should I say anything? Should I not say anything? I decided not to say anything. But I sort of like felt really awkward about it, because I wanted to say to her it might have been the vaccine, and anyway you didn't really need the vaccine because you've had COVID, perhaps you don't need to have the second vaccine. And and of course it's really worrying for her, because she's on her own now, and again she's similar age to me, mid-70s, she's on her own now. And so she needs to be able to drive. And if she has problems with her eyesight and she can't drive, then she's not only sort of like bereaved and on her own and coping with all of those changes, which are difficult enough anyway, but then to be restricted so that she can't, drive down to the shops or anything. She doesn't have a row of shops near to where she lives, so it would always be a question of driving to a shop. I just feel sort of like a great deal of compassion for her, but I also feel sort of terribly frustrated that I can't discuss my inner thoughts with her either. It's just a very tense and difficult situation.
Okay, so who is it, do you think, should and should not? I mean, I've been looking at some reports saying that if you're healthy and under 60, you shouldn't be having a vaccine at all.
I've heard lots of people say that, particularly scientists that are independent, that maybe have retired, and they're no longer funded by anyone, and they feel free to speak out. So many of those are saying exactly that no one should have the vaccine if they're under 60. But I think then I mean, it is difficult, isn't it? Because I think that maybe there's more side effects and maybe more deaths in the people who are having it that are older, the vulnerable people, the people who need protecting. So it's a sort of, I mean, it's just a difficult toss-up, isn't it? You know, I'm not saying that the vaccine doesn't have side effects and may even cause deaths amongst younger people. Of course it does. And one could also argue that it's more tragic if somebody like a mother of 28 who's got two children dies from having the vaccine when she wouldn't have died from COVID. Whereas if you get an 88-year-old grandmother who, I mean, just the law of statistics, she's not going to live very long. She has the vaccine and unfortunately she is vulnerable to it and she dies. But if she'd caught COVID, she also might have died anyway. So it's a difficult toss-up. But I personally think that whilst you've got alternatives, of which there are many, I mean, for example, there's a lot of studies that show that vitamin D, which just is so safe, I mean, you need really high levels in your blood to be toxic. Vitamin D, it acts prophylactically and also helps to stop some of the more serious side effects.
Okay, so just to say that prophylactically, what that means is that you can take it and if you actually get the virus whilst you're on the vitamin D, it can really help your body, gives it a head start in dealing with it.
Absolutely. And also it can stop you from catching it. And then, of course, the ivermectin, which is well shown in studies to have both a prophylactic and a treatment role, and the same for hydroxychloroquine, although the results aren't so concrete with hydroxychloroquine. But when it's taken early, it has quite a good effect. But you know, there's alternatives now that are so safe, that have been used for so many years without side effects. So I just can't see that a vaccine that has a lot of side effects with the elderly who are vulnerable to COVID, you know, maybe they might never have come in contact with the COVID virus. And then the young people, if they'd had COVID, certainly wouldn't have had, it would have been very unusual indeed for them to have a serious disease or for them to die from COVID. And then they're having the vaccine and some of them are having serious health complications and a small number of them are dying. I just feel to me, I just feel there needs to be a lot more research. When you say research, of course, the vaccine has only had a temporary license to be used in an emergency. And you could argue that now the cases are so low that it's no longer an emergency and there's no reason to proceed with the program and that you could just look at the people in the studies and see how they get on.
Okay, look, yeah. Judith, you've been working in these medical fields for many, many years now.
Yes, indeed.
And in many different countries. What is going on? Because it seems as if there's a whole ratchet going on here. As these, you know, you're just describing it there. You know, they've now allowed an emergency vaccine, but there's no longer an emergency, but the vaccine is still allowed. What is going on?
Well, I think that what you were talking about earlier, Tony, the situation with all the new forms of power that are increasing their surveillance, and I think that the vaccine and the vaccine passports, which I would be very surprised if they weren't introduced quite soon, and if they didn't restrict those of us who are not vaccinated. I just think that that it's going to be a way of keeping tabs on the population and collecting a lot of
what you're saying there is really what they've announced this week, isn't it? That the NHS app, I mean, they've made it almost impossible to get an NHS appointment, but you can download the app, which makes it a lot easier. You know, if you need to go and see the doctor, you know, if you've got an ingrown toenail or whatever you've got, you can do it a lot easier with this app. But this app is also going to be used, coordinated with, you know, some sort of system by which you can guarantee that you're COVID secure, that you've had your vaccine, that you've had a test to show you haven't got it. So it almost seems as if they're buying people off by saying, well, you can access the NHS, but only if you buy into this COVID status app, which, you know, reminds me very much of the things that they've got over in China, which flash up either red, amber or green as to whether you're allowed to go out of your house in the morning.
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy, and I just find it very difficult to understand why so many people haven't seen through it, or maybe they have seen through it and they're just keeping their fingers crossed and hoping that if they're the ones who behave and comply, they're the ones that are going to be saved. I don't know, but it's a very distressing situation.
Anyway, there's a lot of people are annoyed about the way that the government's dealt with this. So many, in fact, that we had, well, probably at least 100,000 people out on the streets of London last weekend. I mean, some people saying that it's the biggest demonstration that there's been in the UK since the 2003 Iraq War demonstration. And I know you were down there, Judith, weren't you? Can you just take us through the day?
Yes, it was a lovely day. I mean, we had fantastic weather, and that probably helped with the large number of people that came out onto the streets that day, and people of all ages, of all different ethnic backgrounds. It was really heartening to see it. And I haven't seen such a big demonstration since the Iraq War, but I've got a painful knee at the moment, and I had to keep stopping to rest. In fact, three times I rested between 20 and 30 minutes, expecting that I'd... Each time I thought, well, when the tail end of the demonstration passes, I'll join on the tail end. But in fact, at the end of it, I still hadn't seen the end of the march. And it was very good natured. There were some police about, not many, even the cars that were stopped in the traffic were peeping their horns and showing support for us. Some people waving from windows to support us. So there was a lot of support, a lovely atmosphere, and actually. You know, my husband would have liked to have gone, but we've got a new puppy, so somebody had to stay at home with him. And my neighbours would have liked to have gone, but they were they're taxi drivers, and they had bookings for wedding for the day, so they couldn't go. So in a sense, I felt that I was going on my own, but representing quite a lot of other people. And then having got back and spoken to other people when I've got back, I think that if they when they have the next one, it's quite likely that may be even bigger, I hope it is. Because but what was so disappointing, Tony, I think that the independent media have reported it, but what was so disappointing was that there was absolutely nothing on BBC, absolutely nothing on Sky, nothing on the ITV news. All of the mainstream news just completely ignored it. Well, even if, you know, such a large event, which was... I suppose you have a lot of people getting together, not wearing masks, not necessarily social distancing, singing, chanting, doing all the things that we're told not to do. You would have thought that would have been worthy of the news if the government are wanting a pandemic to story to carry on.
Well, just to say, the next one is in... a fortnight's time, Saturday, yeah. In a fortnight's time, which is 3 weeks after the previous one. You know, I'm sure there'll be, well, I mean, we could be seeing hundreds of thousands of people again in London then. Plus, I know that some various organisations are doing like city protests. So the idea is that you kind of go, I mean, for example, May the 15th is going to be Bristol College Green as well as London. And other dates in other cities. So I'm not sure of the exact dates, but you know, there's quite a coordinated thing here where there's some of them are going on in, I mean, for example, the 1st of May, That is actually this week, this Saturday, is in Liverpool. Saturday, the 8th of May, the in-between week, that's going to be in Brighton. But the 15th is Manchester, Bristol, Edinburgh, London, Hull and Glastonbury, because Glastonbury always likes to get in.
Yeah.
You know, to tell the world that it's just as big as Edinburgh and Manchester, anyway.
Yeah.
Look, in the background to all of this, we've got the future, of course. Where do you see things heading with this, Judith?
Well, I just see a world in which people are going to be much more restricted, much more under surveillance. There's talk of depopulation, i.e. maybe it's talk, I don't know. But I think that jobs are going to be very difficult. It's going to be designed so that social contact is much more difficult. People who, you know, I just keep thinking people who are populations are going to be seriously controlled. And then I keep thinking that when they've reduced jobs by the use of IT, then there's going to be a lot of surplus people that are just going to need to be fed and housed. And I think that they're not going to be necessary to the new regime. And all of these things, I'm not saying that they're going to happen, but they're things that go through my mind. And
well, no, look, I mean, you're absolutely right there to call out this whole thing about home working, because if you have a look at all over the last 20 years, what's been going on is some of the biggest industries have been doing home working, and then people who are working from home suddenly find themselves sacked and their jobs outsourced to another country, for example, or else their jobs taken over by some sort of IT system, you know, or robotics or whatever. So this is a big, big part of this. And also one of the things that this is doing to the whole world, really, I mean, when Britain is no exception, is it's driving a wedge right through society, dividing people into those that are, you know, happy to go along with everything and think it's very dangerous, and others who are saying, well, actually, we need to change the whole system because this is, you know, actually destroying society, this agenda. And also you mentioned there a bit about depopulation, but I think, you know, that's not just scaremongering, because if you look at Bill Gates, who's one of the major funders of the whole vaccine program and always has been, well, over the last 20 years, you know, his family is a eugenics family. These people are there to make sure that the human, I mean, this is the science, what they call a science. And how disgusting a word is that? It's more of the Nazi Dr. Mengele style science, the science of perfecting humanity.
Indeed. Who would want to be perfect?
No, exactly. So, you know, this is, I don't think you're scaremongering talking about depopulation, is what I'm saying there, Judith.
No, I think that, in a sense, they're just the fears that go through my mind. And I'm not saying that they're definitely going to happen. But I'm saying that they're the fears that go through my mind. And I'm just sharing them with you at the moment, and as just frightening possibilities. And it's those frightening possibilities that makes me feel that I've just got to carry on fighting. Not for me, you know, Tony. When you're in your mid-70s, I'm going to die of something in the next 10 years probably. And I don't care whether it's an infection, cancer, heart attack. You know, I don't have any preference for the way that I'm going to die at all. And I don't worry about one any more than the other. And if everything got too oppressive and too terrible, I've had a wonderful life and I could, you know, top myself and I wouldn't feel regret if things were really, really terrible in my life. But I've got children, I've got grandchildren, I see young families all around me, I see these young people on these marches who deserve to have the sort of freedom that I've enjoyed throughout my whole life. So I just feel I've got to keep on fighting for them. That's my perspective anyway.
Yeah, well, that's good, isn't it? I mean, you know, also I draw a parallel with poor old Julian Assange rotting in Belmarsh, who's done absolutely nothing.
Yes.
And he has now been put into the situation where he has got to contemplate killing himself, committing suicide, because he doesn't want to spend the whole of his life in some sort of torture chamber in the United States or in isolation in Guantanamo Bay for doing absolutely nothing. And so he's being used basically as like a political pawn. But anyway, look, I mean, thinking about the wider picture in geopolitics, I know it's something that you're really, familiar with, having worked for these UN programs, etc. What do you make of what's been going on in Yemen? Because we're now over 100,000 people dead there. It's painted out as some sort of terrible thing that the Iranians are doing, if you want to believe that, even though the British, the Americans and the Saudi Arabians started bombing, started the war. In fact, give us a basic idea, if you can, in like just a few sentences, in a nutshell, of what is actually that conflict really all about?
Well, I think now, Tony, it's very difficult to know what it's all about, because it just seems as if there's various actors fighting their battles throughout Yemen, which is very fragmented, and each group feels that they're fighting for a different thing, or maybe they don't even know what they're fighting for. They're fighting because they're fighting.
There's all this fighting has kicked off also over in Ethiopia. I think a similar sort of conflict where you've got yourself a Western-backed puppet president who starts off okay. He seems to be quite a nice chap. Then he starts getting really nasty to such an extent that most of the country want to get rid of him. And that seems to be a parallel in many countries, not least of which Ethiopia and Yemen.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that initially it did start off as a power battle between Hadi, who was the the recognized president, but not really. His term had actually expired, and the ousted previous president Saleh. And I think it started off as a power struggle between the two of them. And of course, Hadi, the army backed Saleh, and so therefore Hadi hadn't got an army to back him, and that's why he went to Saudi Arabia. And I think the reason why Saudi Arabia joined in was because they thought that they'd got so many weapons that they could, drop a few bombs and the Houthis would surrender almost immediately and that they would win the war. I mean, I know that some people feel that the Houthis are a sort of like they're standing up against the West and therefore they have to be right. But they themselves do horrible things and are just as repressive as each other group in all the other parts of Yemen. I think that the main thing is that they have managed to keep the North together and that they seem to have a very good tactics of fighting. I think the Iranian involvement now is significant. I mean, it's not as significant as the Saudi involvement, but having said that, I think it was mostly rhetoric at the beginning of the war. I think that they've been drawn into Yemen more during the course of the war, so therefore it's a situation where exactly the opposite to what the Saudis aimed for has actually happened. The Saudis are at the moment making nice noises towards the Houthis and saying, well, they're Arabs and they think like Yemenis and maybe we can do a deal and we can help them financially. But I just feel that that it's going to be very difficult for Saudi Arabia to solve the war by making a few nice statements about the Houthis. This is a recent thing. Biden, of course, came to power saying that he was going to end the war in Yemen, and then decided all that he was going to do was not give them so many precision weapons. And the UK government immediately stepped in and said that they would provide the shortfall. So nothing's changed there. Biden's idea is to have ceasefires and peace talks, which has been everybody's idea for the last 6 years and hasn't got anywhere. it's quite interesting when you're talking about COVID, because Yemen has been COVID free for a long time. It hasn't existed in Yemen. I mean, when people have so many other problems, they don't worry about COVID and they don't worry about the COVID restrictions. But recently they've started rolling out the vaccine in the government controlled areas, or the loosely government controlled areas in the south. And of course, what would you expect? But the number of COVID cases and the number of COVID deaths has started to increase there in Yemen, just by coincidence, exactly the same in every other country where the vaccine rollout has happened. But I can't see the end to the war in Yemen, Tony. I think it's the, one of the things that's so sad is that you've even got families that are split. Like, for example, on the front line in Marib, which is the one of the latest horrendous wars that are going on there. They actually recently had, I think it was a son who was killed fighting for the Houthis, and a father that was killed fighting for Ali Mohsin's brigades opposing the Houthis. And they were actually killed on the same day fighting opposite sides. You know, I mean, what on earth was that about? What on earth is this war about? I've even heard about in Taiz where people fight for one side in the day and another side at night so that they get double pay by doing double shifts. I mean, it's just crazy.
Well, yeah, that's the sort of thing. It reminds me very much of the al-Nusra, ISIS, al-Qaeda situation in Syria, where, you know, these mercenaries were hopping around from one group to another depending on who's going to pay them the most.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just a crazy situation. But of course,
there is. I mean, what do you, okay, so look, it's easy to say crazy, Judith, and I don't want to be rude, but, you know, people called Hitler crazy. I don't think he was. I think he was very determined. And no one would agree with his aims, but it was actually a really devious, devilish plan he had. And to say it's crazy almost sort of dehumanizes. These people are human, you know, but they're extremely devious in their ways of doing stuff. So I suppose the question is what's the object, do you think?
Yeah, the thing is, I think that probably most of the people that are fighting are pawns. I think there are people, you know, like that small percentage of 1% that are controlling the narrative relating to COVID and vaccines. They control the which wars are going to be fought and how and ways of sort of like continuing so that they can never end. I mean, I'm sure that the Saudis wish that they had never agreed to go into war in Yemen, because it's devastated their economy, and also it's made it difficult for them to maintain any sort of like moral position in the world. And because they haven't been able to win the battle, it's actually made them look like incompetent fools at warmongering, which of course they are. So I think that nobody who's actually down there fighting has actually won. I think that there are people sitting probably in the Pentagon or some other place, such place, who are actually planning these killing fields that are dotting the world, the Middle East especially, but other places as well. And I just think that perpetual war is their aim, and that's, as you say, it's not that they're crazy, it's just that perpetual war is their plan and it's working.
Okay, so just to round up with the COVID stuff, we've got, so the 15th of May, Saturday, a worldwide demonstration day going on. Also, the Saturday, the 1st of May in Liverpool, Saturday, the 8th of May in Brighton. And also, the groups are also saying the 29th of May, which is 2 weeks after the 15th, going on in central London. But it's interesting looking at some... some of the groups involved in this, you know, you've got Save Our Rights, you've got the World Freedom Alliance, which is largely doctors, You've got a Stand in the Park, which is a group which is asking people to come to one of their local parks every week. You've got Stop New Normal, which is Piers Corbyn. And he is standing as one of the candidates for London Mayor. It looks like he might do actually quite well, in fact. And there's another one called The Great Reopening, which was an attempt to get people to reopen their businesses before the official dates in June, I believe. And there's something called Stand Up X, also Event 202, and another group called Make Lockdowns History. So there's quite a big coalition of people involved in all of this stuff now, Judy.
Yeah. Well, let's hope, Tony. We mustn't give up hope. We've got to keep on the struggle, and we know we're right. It's just that we need to convince others that we're right.
Yeah, and also the people who are wrong seem to have managed to wheedle their way into some quizzling positions of power around the country. The other thing, of course, is that we're getting a load of nonsense from the mass media. So have you got, maybe you could just round off with a couple of places people can go to get a bit more reliable information, get, you know, news daily.
Well, I think that the best news programme at the moment is the UK Column News, which goes on Monday, Wednesdays and Fridays. And the reason for that is because it is a news programme that goes out sort of, well, nationally, but also internationally. It is, people from abroad listen to it. And it actually looks at the news in a very constructive way, with lots of really good sources. All of their material is sourced. And they are having quite a hard time at the moment, obviously, as you might expect, because they've been working on vaccine reactions and for example, they've been booted off YouTube. But I think that we need to get behind them and support them. But there's also, because in Bristol, there's Dan Gregory doing the pandemic podcast. I think that he's very good. There's Anna Breeze, who used to be the journalist with the BBC, who set up an alternative media company. James Dellingpole as well. He's does Rumble News. So there's quite a few out there. But just as a good start, I would definitely recommend UK Column News, because it's three times a week and it really is an investigative news programme, doing old-fashioned investigative journalism. And I think that would be my number one source.
Okay. Finally, you were there on Saturday. Can you give us an estimate of numbers? Because I've heard so many different estimates. What's yours, Judith?
Well, when I was there on the day, I thought this can't be less than 500,000. And then somebody's done some drone surveys, said that they estimated it was 500,000. It was between 500,000 and 750,000. I wouldn't dispute that. It was a huge march. I wouldn't dispute 500,000. Of course, it's impossible to count. And the way that it collects as well, because they just say meet in central London and people collect at different points in central London. So when I first joined up with this group, which was a few thousand people in Hyde Park, and I thought, oh, well, it hasn't been well publicised. I suspect that, you know, a few thousand is quite good. But then once we started on the march and you, all of the other people who were meeting in different places in London all joined in, you're suddenly aware of how big it was. And it was just colossal. I wouldn't dispute 500,000. I would think it may have been in that region.
Okay, so we're looking at 15th of May, 2021, for what they're calling One Day Everyone Together. But that will also be some demonstrations going on in regional cities around the country. But then the really big one, if I'm allowed to call it the really big one, for Saturday the 29th of May. Judith Brown, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.